The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, welcome to MotoGP OD. This is episode 168, and this is Jules Cheesek and Jim Race, and we're going to be talking together and doing the show together in a little more looser format this week. So, hey, Jim.
How are you doing, Jules?
Good.
Good.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So, last week you had the interview with Eugene. It was very cool. And today I thought we would talk a little bit about... We're going to talk about superbikes coming up this weekend, and I kind of wanted to just talk about the Bob and I did a review of the 2008 MotoGP season, but we never really covered the 250s and 125s, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I just wanted to give some highlights and such about the season. There was much more racing in the 250s and 125s than the MotoGP. We had some races that were won on the last corners by inches and such.
So, you're being kind.
What's that?
You're being kind.
Yeah, exactly. So, in the 250s, we had a relative unknown guy, Marco Simoncelli. I mean, he's pretty well known in the in Italy and in Europe, but definitely not in the States and probably other countries outside of Europe. So, and he didn't seem like the guy that would be the championship material. I think everybody was expecting Bautista and Callio, and even like Alex de Bon, because he had a he was on the Aprilia factory ride.
Sure.
Even Hector Barbera, was probably ranked higher than Simoncelli.
I think the season, at least in 250s, kind of surprised everybody a little bit. Obviously, it was going to be good racing, especially with the threat, which later came to be of the fact that things were clearly going to be changing down the road. But like you say, Simoncelli was an unlikely champion. And I think part of that was just because of his
hair,
body size and hair, his look. And while he had a great season in 2007, he did not look like he was going to be charging to the forefront and leading the way that he did.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't even secure a factory ride. He was an Aprilia, as they say, LE, which is a 2007 version of the bike.
But not the RSA.
And it was actually even branded as a Galera, which is, a very historic marquee for GP racing.
Sure.
But it's not really a Galera. I don't know what of it is Galera aside from the name.
Bold new graphics.
There you go. So then we had a bunch of guys step up from the 125s. I mean, Bautista, everybody, did he compete in 2007?
Yes, he did.
In the 250s? Yeah, he did. So he stepped up in 2007, that's right. But that was still the Lorenzo year, so him and Dovizioso put up a good fight.
Bautista was fourth in 2007.
Everybody kind of expected, I think, that once Lorenzo was gone, that it was going to be the Bautista show, and with some Mika Kallio and maybe even Hiroshi Ayama, because they had, the KTMs were a little bit underpowered, but they were very nimble, and aside from a couple of straights, power doesn't really mean that much if you can ride the bike well. Kallio is an extremely consistent rider, so.
It seemed that those two actually, with the exception of some hiccups by Ayama in 2007, they actually worked really well as a team.
That's true too. Yeah.
And you were speaking about Lorenzo leaving the 250s in 2007, but the guys right behind him were Davi and DeAngelis, and they were gone too. So next in line was Bautista in fourth. So, it was kind of wide open, and Simoncelli was way down there in 10th and not somebody that you were going to really think about as being near the top of the pops.
Right. Yeah, and you had the first two races in Qatar. Simoncelli crashed, and we had, he didn't, and then we had this incredible race in Jerez, where basically it was Bautista and Simoncelli. Simoncelli, kind of surprised everybody during that race, but then Bautista had a mechanical failure. I think did he actually seize the motor?
I think
he seized it, or it was like a transmission thing. But
I think it was like they said a soft seize, but the end result didn't really matter what caused it. One of the nastiest accidents of last year.
Yeah, and he ran into Simoncelli and took them both out, and that handed the victory to Mika Kallio, who had finished third in Qatar, so now he was leading the championship. Actually, I think at this point he was still behind Pessini, because Pessini won in Qatar and took second in Jerez, so Pessini was still leading at this point, but it was Mika Kallio that was looking really, really strong.
Indeed.
And we went off to Portugal, which Bautista won, and Simoncelli took second. Kallio took third, and now Kallio at this point was leading because Pessini crashed. So, Pessini was just moved up on 125s, right? And he got in the pre-RSA ride, which is kind of interesting because it was his rookie season, and he got on a factory ride. I guess Aprilia had five RSA machines, so a lot to go around.
And I don't think they had RSA stickers for Gilera at that point yet.
That's right. That wasn't until...
I think it was like this...
Germany, this, maybe? I think...
If I try and call it, somebody's going to call us on it, so I'll say it was later in the season.
Yeah. I think it was either Germany or Assen where Simoncelli finally got a RSA sticker. Well, more than a sticker, obviously, because it was he had ridden the bike during a test in Brno, I think, probably, and was like, ooh, this bike is a lot better, a lot more power. So,
12 horsepower and carbon fiber swing arm sticker.
Right. So we have to definitely talk about Italy, because that was one crazy race. Barbera and Simoncelli fighting.
Literally.
Yeah, and Barbera had definitely more power on the straight, so he was always repassing Simoncelli by the time they got to the finish line. And this was I think that Simoncelli was getting very frustrated because he would lead the entire lap. I mean, he would catch Barbera. This happened like 10 laps in a row. He would catch Barbera like halfway through the lap, then lead, try to get some lead, and then on the final corner lead enough so that he could lead it across the finish line, but it just never worked. I mean, Barbera was always in the draft.
He couldn't break him.
He could come out of the draft, and then this crazy incident happened where a couple laps from the end, and I think that it was a very dangerous maneuver from Simoncelli. I mean, I don't think he was trying to hit Barbera, but he definitely was swerving to get him at least to not give him an easy ride in the draft. But what ended up happening is that the rear of Simoncelli's bike made contact with the front, with a very particular part of the front of Barbera's bike, which is of course the brake lever, which is not good when you're going at full speed. And that was, I don't know if you remember the replays of that. It was pretty nasty.
I do.
Barbera basically like just endo from hell.
He did a Jeeber now.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Yep. From you talking about the Assen one?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, was that Catalunya? That was Catalunya.
That was Catalunya, yeah.
Yeah, Catalunya in 2006.
Five? I don't know.
Yeah.
All Marlboro colors. So yeah, 2005 or 2006.
Well, 5, he was still in on the Honda.
Yeah,
because that was the unraveling with the Jerez thing. Anyway, so yeah, it was crazy, and I think that Simoncelli did deserve some blame. There was a lot of Dorna made. I think he actually had to pay a fine. He was definitely slapped in the wrist by both the FIM and Dorna.
And a hardcore virtual hazing from the millions of online fans. There was nobody that was happy with him for that.
Right.
Except for 3 or 4 Simoncelli Muppets at the time.
Yeah, well, we were all kind of becoming Muppets at this point because he really does have some style, you know, and he has a lot of the same qualities that Rossi has. And not just in writing, his aggressive writing, but also, you know, he is this lanky, tall dude that just doesn't seem to fit the bike, you know, among a sea of, you know, kind of jockeys. So,
I think the difference being is that you can always kind of see that there's a little bit of a mad devil schemer in Rossi's eyes, and all you really ever see in Simoncelli's is like this dude that's like really happy or really pissed, one of the two.
Or stoned.
Although that's probably not in the program, and I'm sure the anti-doping controls that the FIM has put in place will have taken care of that.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was a turning point, I think, in the championship, because he won the race. It was the first race that he won. And then he won Catalunya, placed second in Britain. And he was still actually, Mika Kallio was still leading at this point. Mika Kallio,
he was very consistent.
Yeah, he was very consistent. He won China, he won Britain. But then Simoncelli and Bautista traded some wins in Assen and in Germany. And I think by this time, Simoncelli was on a RSA Aprilia. And from this point on, he was very, very strong. Although he did have a crappy race at Misano, for which he was apologized profusely because there was a huge fan club that came out to see it.
Well, there were other things in that Misano race that were of great interest as well.
Yeah, actually, there was not that many people that we had a lot of non-finishes, I believe.
We did, and we also had the banging scrap to the end between.
Oh my God! This was the race. You're right. This was the one where Barbera became the evil one.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's always been one of the craziest riders out there, but this was the one where it was caught on film from many different angles with many different riders. And yeah, I think Simoncelli actually went down. That's right. Simoncelli actually crashed.
He did.
Because he was so, I think he was just really pissed. He was just that pissed at Barbera.
It became the, not even the win it or bin it, just pass this mofo and
do something to him, you know?
Yeah. It was full on red mist, and probably not the best thinking that could have been done, but from a fan perspective, if you take away the end result, which was a 6 for him,
it was a 6 place.
It was still I remember the announcers basically talking there was going to be a huge blow up in the Park for Mayor, the paddock afterwards. And I think
the guy that was really the most pissed was actually Pessini.
Yep.
And I have to say that, you know, I've watched that pass that Barbera did on Pessini a few times, and I'm not really sure that Barbera was really at fault on that particular one. I mean, I think everybody was kind of just getting pissed at him because they were watching him ahead of him.
Right.
Ahead of them, you know, just doing crazy stuff. And then you know, Kallio and Hiroshi took each other out as well in this race.
I remember that, yeah.
And Kallio was very upset about it. But if you look at the way these guys ride on that track, they have very different lines. And basically, Ayama just had a very different braking point, caught out Kallio, who I guess got almost brake checked basically, and ran into the back of him, and they took each other out.
I'm remembering that right now because they had some great onboard camera work and seeing both of the KTM bikes go down together.
Right. Right, from both sides of the story. Yeah. So anyway, but then we went to Indy, and we were there, and we didn't get to see the 250s. We got to see them qualify and do even warm up.
Then we got to interview Simoncelli on the streets.
That's right.
He was drunk, and I think we were probably a little happy ourselves.
Yeah, that was great. And but unfortunately, they didn't get to race because the race got postponed to after the MotoGP race. The MotoGP race could start on time. And then the hurricane was just so nasty. The wind was just so strong, and obviously the bikes being a lot lighter, and even the MotoGP bikes getting canceled. They did cancel it. I mean, you remember, like, the sun was coming out, and it looked like, hey, we could have a race, but the wind just would not let out.
Yeah. Well, and there was stuff still blowing around all over the place. I mean, the track was in no condition.
Yeah.
It's interesting. If I've rewatched the Indy GP race a few times and done some pausing at certain parts in the corners when you could actually see things, and you pause and you see this stuff blowing across the track.
Oh yeah.
Just that's amazing, right? Kind of debris. And you know, those guys were real stalwarts to actually run through that. That's some serious brass ones going on there. But yeah, I don't think the track or the facilities or anything. We had, you know, we were on power going out and all that stuff and buildings collapsing. I think it was the best thing. You know, it was disappointing, certainly. It was the first time in many, many years, actually the first time that I would have ever seen all three classes. I remember seeing the 250s a lot down in Laguna Seca back in the 80s. But, you know, it was going to be the big triple threat. And, you know, we got to see him in qualifying and in free practice and stuff, and that was cool. But, you know, you always focus on the race. And, yeah, it was a bummer to miss out. But
yeah.
Such is life.
Hopefully we'll get to see him this year. Although you said you're probably not going to Indy.
I think the economy is probably going to keep me closer to home this year.
Then Simoncelli, I think Simoncelli after Germany was leading the championship, and even though he didn't win any races for 3 weekends, well, Indy was a no go. Callio had the even worse results. He had non-finishes and so on. So, and just poor finishing. So it was really Bautista's was the only person who could really challenge him after a while, and he didn't. So,
well, I mean, he did.
I mean, Japan was an incredible race. Australia was an incredible race. But Simoncelli won them both, and then he only needed to finish on the podium in Malaysia to get the championship, and he did. He got his third place.
And that was a brutal race.
That was the race that was, like, you know, hot.
Yeah, and hot for many reasons, primarily the temperature, but it was still a great race, a fun race to watch. Actually, we haven't mentioned DeBone a lot. He was actually kind of threatening a little bit during certain parts of the season.
He was. I think after Italy, he was second or something like that, or third in the championship.
Yeah, I like the look of the Lotus Aprilia too. It was always easy to spot.
Right.
dropping all the way back to Indy, we still got the opportunity to talk to a lot of these people, which certainly never happens because we don't get overseas like any of us would like to. So putting names to faces and faces to bikes and all that was pretty cool. But and so Malaysia was nuts, and that was a great race, and he didn't get fined for taking whoever that hitchhiker was around the track. Wait, that was him, or was that Bautista?
No, it was Bautista. It was Bautista. No, Simoncelli got fined for taking his helmet off and doing on his cool down lap, which was not a cool down at all because the temperature was just sweltering. It was so humid.
Yeah.
And with all that hair, you know.
Natural air conditioning.
Yeah.
That race for pretty much all the classes looked like it was probably about to kill him. But
yeah. Yeah.
Still. And then so that was a done deal. And then the rest of it was just gravy from there going on to. So then they moved on to Valencia. And for pretty much GP and 250, it was just a relaxing race, as Valencia often is. 125s, correct me if I'm wrong, was the only folks that had a championship still to decide.
I thought the DiMeglio took the championship in Australia.
Were they done?
Maybe you're right. Let me check really quick.
See, it was such a good lead-in too.
Oh yeah. I think Australia is. Yeah, DiMeglio won in Australia. He won the race and locked up the championship in Australia.
Okay. So then Valencia was one of those end of the year races that Valencia can often be.
Yeah.
And it 250s and 125s, if I remember correctly. I was kind of winding down myself. We're still great races. The GP race was probably the most processional, boring thing that we've seen in some time.
Yeah.
Not the best way to end up the season, but hey, put it to bed, put it to
right,
rest.
Right.
And then I can't remember. I think we had a lot of stuff going on at the Japan time frame as far as announcements and all that. And most of it was pertaining to
single tires.
Yeah, single tires and all that stuff coming down. But do you remember when the announcement came out for the Moto 2?
Well, the rumors, I think, started around
early season.
No, just after the summer break.
And everyone
was kind of like, no way. But I don't think it was actually made official until after the season ended.
But at what point did KTM say we're not coming back?
Yes, but that was already, I think, after the season ended. It was after. You may be right, though. I don't remember the chronology exactly.
Yeah.
I'm sure that if you look at like Kropotkin's Thinks blog, everything is there chronological order, and you can know exactly when things happen.
It seems to me that the buildup of that for the 250s during the season is what spurred KTM to say, "Well, screw it." And we're heading out, but on the other hand, they're still going to be back. Just at least they're not back at all this year, except for 125. So,
right.
But a strong 125 team, if I remember correctly. You know, the GP season needs to get going because my mind right now is so wrapped around World Superbike.
I know. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Very quick wrap up of 125s. Mike DiMeglio, first French champion since. You know, this is a good trivia question.
Was Jacques 125 guy?
Let's say first French champion period since when?
You got me.
It was I was also like, oh yeah, of course Olivier Jacques, but it's not actually in 2002. The 125 world champion was Arnaud Vincent.
Oh, okay. Vincent.
Yeah, I guess. and he kind of disappeared after that. So that's why we probably don't remember him.
Where'd he go?
He retired.
Oh, okay. Oh, he was too old, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think was, he's like 35 now or something. So,
and he'd grown to like 5'4", and he therefore
yeah. So DiMeglio won the championship. Simon Corsi did put up a really good fight. Won a lot of races. I think he won 1, 2, 3, 4 races and was on the podium a lot. Gabo Talmaxi, the championship in 2007, he really didn't come on until later in the season, and he looked very strong in the end of the season, but. It was already gone by then. He wasn't going to really catch them.
And he also is...
He's moving up to the 250s.
Because he was at the max age limit as well, I believe.
Yep. So it'll be interesting to see because I think we're going to have a lot of young riders that we've been kind of watching for a little while. Bradley Smith, Espargaro, we've got Scott Redding.
Mm-hmm.
So those guys, Steve Bonsi might do well. Who knows? A lot of these guys are going to be the big guys are leaving. So
yeah,
so it'll be interesting.
And at the same time, the people that are coming, people that are staying in 125s, are going to be great. The people that are transitioning into 250s will be very interesting to watch. But it will also be happening to keep an eye on who does well in the 250s and potentially in the transition or in the move to the theoretical transition year, which is a combination class if that's going to work out.
Right.
With whatever testing they're doing with CEV this year to next year to see what's going to happen.
Yeah. I think a lot of the riders in the 250s this year are going to be shooting for MotoGP.
Yeah.
And
there's not a lot of seats.
Well, there's not a lot of seats because I mean, I don't think it's going to change all that much in 1 year. So this Moto2 class is going to be very interesting.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are some that either stay or maybe even move back to 125 if they're not at that top tier.
Right.
There are some that transition to or that stay with the 250 during a mixed year. There are some that go to the Moto2 bikes if there's new teams created. If you'd asked me at whatever point last year Moto2 was announced, I would have been another one of those guys that, you know, were thinking, God damn, this is another nail in the coffin. What's going on? It's growing on me a little bit.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think all these things, like the single tire rule, this kind of stuff, it's like, you know, I'm over it. It's like,
there's no use fighting about it anymore.
Yeah.
It's a done deal.
Yeah.
And it's not, it's probably one of those rules. It's not one of the rules that as Paletta is going to bounce back and forth on. It's going to be one that's probably here and it's probably going to stay. Not like, you know, engine displacement or whatever. And Moto2, I think it may not necessarily be the way things are going. I don't necessarily believe that two strokes are dead at this point, at least from a technological perspective. But I still see the formula as an interesting and viable platform, and one that I think, if it is administered right, could be pretty good for privateer. There's no such thing as a privateer team at this level of racing, but a non-factory team, let's call it.
Right. So, especially in the first few years where
it's going to be totally experimentation and fun.
Exactly. Yeah. So that means that, like, even the factories that have a lot of dough are going to make mistakes. And also, yep. I mean, you know, how much less are they going to provide to the satellite teams, you know?
Yeah. Well, the engine claiming rule is kind of a weird thing, but right. I think nobody's going to spend an awful lot of money on. I think what you're going to see is a lot of relatively standardized bikes with pretty exotic chassis, and maybe some people doing some pretty weird stuff, but with somewhat bog standard engines, you know. And it will be a rider's race for the most part, I hope.
So you know, whenever you and I talk, we always make like these obtuse references.
Okay.
let's explain this engine rule. I actually don't quite understand exactly how it works. Do you understand how it works?
I think I do. There is a 20,000 pound, essentially what is kind of universally known in racing as a claiming rule. And I believe the latest talk to that they're talking about having it modified to a certain way or whatever is that you can only claim a team can only claim one engine, I believe, a season, which is probably a wise limitation. If you claim an engine from another competitor, that you hand them 20,000 euros or do it through Dorna or whoever, they give you the engine. They give you the engine without any electronics, without any of the intake stuff. It is the block with the heads and no exhaust, none of that stuff. So it's not like you're getting a plug-and-play
power plant
to put into your motorcycle. You're getting the core of what a team has built. And so if you're not getting the things that are on the outside or that are really the true IP stuff, right? You know, the exhaust technology, the ECU and all that, which is really where these teams are going to be making the power they want out of these engines, although you can infer a lot of that by compression and stroke and all that.
Right.
You're getting a hunk of metal that has no spare parts, and all you're getting it for is a something to tear down and look at. Unless you're, you know, it seems to me that the big manufacturers, if those come out and make, you know, engines for this class, somebody might claim those one of those, but they can probably buy them for about the same price. So what's the point? Along with that, you know, intellectual property that tells you how to run the thing. The only time somebody's going to buy an engine is if it comes from some outsider and the thing kicks all sorts of ass, and so a team buys one, you know. And I don't think anybody's going to buy one because they think somebody's cheating. Well, here's where I think that the dangers lie for that claiming rule. And I could talk about this all day, but I won't.
Apparently.
Well, I think it's important to
understand. Good.
If you've got a small team that has managed to make put together a good chassis engine combination, and they poured a lot of hours into an engine, and they may only have one or two, but they've got it right, but don't have a lot of cash behind them. Well, if you put, you know, 100,000 euros of man hours into building this engine, and you've only got one other one, and it's a B bike, and somebody claims it for 20 euros, do you have the money to put together another? So I think that might be tough for some of the less financed teams. But are they going to get to that spot? It's hard to say. I don't think people are going to be intentionally screwing others over, but you never know. You know, just buying it to mess with somebody. That's a concern.
And when do you make the claim? You make it after the race?
I think you have to do it within 30 to 60 minutes after a race, somewhere in a very, very short time.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. This is like a very interesting strategic kind of element, but
it's
unlikely they're going to be taking too much advantage of it unless, like you said, somebody really just kicks ass and it's like,
Right. So somebody's going to really want to know. Traditionally in racing, there have been claiming rules throughout racing's time, and they've traditionally worked really poorly because, regardless of what you might think of as a very bloodthirsty sport, there is still a sort of a base level of cooperation, and claiming has never worked very well because you rarely get what you want, which is you want that piece that works great on your bike.
Right.
Well, you're not going to get that. Even if, you know, there's stories in the past, and I'm sure they're fully valid of, you know, in the States at least, and I'm sure in other series of people claiming, you know, it used to be cheap to do claiming. And I think that there's still rules like this. You could claim, you know, superbike forks off of a team for $7,500. Well, we all know that the top superbike forks off of a team these days cost, you know, mega times that.
Right.
But the funny thing is you get the forks, and A, they wouldn't work on your bike, and B, they probably weren't working very well at all, because by the time they got to you, they might not be in the same adjustment range or even have any fluid or parts in them at all.
When you claim the engine, there's no rules that you have to use it, right? I mean, it's just you can take it apart and like study it and see if you can figure out like what's attached to it and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. But the reason that the claiming has to occur so quickly is so that the bike can be acquired. I believe the engine comes out. I don't know if they've worked all this out, but it would make sense for the engine to come out under the scrutineers of Dorna,
right,
at the location, and make sure that the proper parts got to the proper people and the other people kept the parts they were supposed to have, and that nothing was damaged in the process and all the due paperwork was filled out. Will it happen? I don't know. It'll add another thing for people to talk about if it does.
Yeah.
But it certainly is an interesting restriction. Do I see the money that goes into an engine is not a $20,000 lump of metal that's worth $20,000. It's got however many man hours you put in, whatever those are worth. And that's where the worth comes of an engine. Whether somebody can make use of that without all the accessories is a question still to be answered.
Yeah, I guess the engineers will know. They'll have to make the decision. Like, can I?
Is it worth it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And is it worth that team? Is it worth the whole damn series being pissed at me because I messed with somebody?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Nobody likes somebody that you know, does that stuff.
It's going to be interesting when they do that on a weekend where there's only, well, I mean, when the next race is the next weekend. I mean, like, that really puts the other team like in a quandary to like come up with a new motor. I mean, I'm sure they have all these spares lying around, but, you know.
Well, it does if you're a factory GP team. I mean, you know, that's not really, yeah, you're give me 20,000 euros, we're going to go have a little nice dinner tonight. Right, but if you're a, you know, a satellite team, they take it back to a couple of years ago with, you know, some of the satellite teams getting Honda engines they couldn't even crack open. You got Team KR, who doesn't even exist anymore because they could only get, like, what, two engines a weekend in the boast?
Right.
So it'll need to be monitored and looked at and make sure that nobody gets screwed over.
Interesting. That's a puts an interesting spin. We'll see if it happens. It's kind of like the flag-to-flag thing. We didn't really know how it was going to work until we saw it, and then it was pandemonium.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Well, cool. Thanks, man. Let's talk about World Superbikes. That's coming up.
That is coming up. So that's coming up this weekend, and it is at Qatar.
It's a daytime race.
For a change, and also on a Saturday. So we are doing this on late Wednesday night and don't have any prelim results yet, or we'd be passing those along to you. We were talking about this a bit. There's been some weather down. Well, we had weather, what, 2 weekends ago with the MotoGP teams testing down there. They couldn't test at all on their first night, or only a couple of guys could.
It was raining. That's crazy. I mean, it was like pouring crazy.
Yeah. And the guys that did go out there. But anyway, the weather down there this time, there was a storm. There was a storm that came in off of the Gulf, or one of the Gulfs. That sounds really nationalistic U.S. dumb. But and then there was another one that came over from Saudi Arabia, knowing a little bit of my geography, and there was a bunch of dust storms. So I think the bottom line is the track is going to be the shape of the track is going to be interesting. It's going to be relatively hot down there, and it's not too bad right now. But it's always an abrasive track and has sand there and can be kind of a mess. So you saw
video of this storm.
I started to watch it, and if you've ever seen pictures or video of the sandstorms that happen in the Middle East, these things are amazing. I mean, they tower, you know, a half mile, a mile high, and they look like this slow brown black wave coming at you. You know, like something out of your nightmare. It's not a pretty sight. When they hit, they're just huge, and it's like, find a place inside, cover yourself up, whatever you can do to protect yourself, and everything stops when they go. I don't know if it made it over that way. I unfortunately have not been checking up on that part of the weather real quick. I can check real quickly, though, the weather there right now. 2 seconds, please.
Mm-hmm.
And if this will behave, come on, my weather link. And we'll have to see how it goes. Let me see. So Friday, it's the high is going to be at 3 p.m., 27 centigrade. That's warm, not too hot. Light winds. Today, right now, like there, I guess it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and it is currently 23 with about an 8-mile-an-hour wind, nice and sunny. So winds aren't going to be over 10, and that doesn't sound too bad. Sounds kind of good.
Cool.
Keep the track clean. They're running both, of course, World Super Sport and World Superbike, as well as a national and international Qatari series there. And so,
which is it still being run by what's his name? That used to, God, I can't believe everybody's forgetting his name. Who used to run Pramac?
Oh, really? Luis Dantin?
Yeah, Dantin. Dantin used to run or provide bikes there.
I mean, that's right. When that was how kind of Liam got his in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. it seems to me like he dropped off the map, and if he was going to drop off it, that'd probably be a good place to drop to.
Right.
I really, you know, interesting how I heard very, very little after that whole split.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In fact, it was quiet enough to be a vacuum that just made you go, okay, what's going on?
No, I'm positive, and yeah. I'm guessing. I haven't actually heard this from Liam, because he hasn't said anything about it either, but yeah. But I'm positive that they put a blanket over it and said, you know, don't talk about this for at least 12 months and whatever.
Sure.
You know.
And it was effective and probably the best thing because
immediately afterwards we had some great racing.
And let's get business. And although certainly at the end of the season there were some wholesale changes made with that team. For many reasons, not only because of that, but because of the economy and all that other crap that's given us the state of racing that we have today. But World Superbike and World Supersport, alive and well, totally solid, full fields. Nothing to complain about there. You couldn't even tell that there was a nickel missing. You couldn't. I mean, you got 32 bikes in the superbike field, 7 brands, a kick-ass first race down at Phillip Island, one that was great with some unexpected and hopeful things for a bunch of people.
Yeah, yeah. I loved seeing the Aprias and even the Beamers did okay in the first race.
They went okay, and Corsair set the track record in the second race, I believe. And so they're coming to Qatar, where I believe Corsair and Biaggi, Corsair last year had pole. It was Corsair, Chaus, Neukirchner was fourth, and third, I want to say, was Biaggi.
Biaggi's always done well.
So your front row was Corsair, Chaus, Neukirchner, and Biaggi. And so you've got both Corsair and Biaggi on different bikes this year. Which was kind of interesting. I noticed on one of the forums that people were like, oh, because Ducati put out this press release saying, oh, we got to watch out for Biaggi and Corsair in Qatar. And I saw a bunch of people, Americans, imagine that, going, why didn't they mention Spies? You know, because clearly he was a threat down in Phillip Island in one race too. First off, you write press releases to generate buzz. And that's what you want it to do. So you got a bunch of buzz generated from that. But this is the reason they were on the front row, and that's why you talk about them, because it's unknown. And I believe when they tested the BMWs down here, Corsair was fast as well. So I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be a interesting race. Be nice to see Qatar again in the daytime.
yeah, that's right. We haven't seen it.
Yeah,
in 2 years. So, we saw the superbikes last year. Who do you like in superbikes? Besides, just don't say like, well, I just like to watch the racing. I mean, you've got to have some people that you're kind of going, oh, I wish they could do better or whatever.
Okay. Without a doubt, I can say that I'm excited about Spies doing well for a lot of different reasons. Part of it is nationalistic pride, because I know that he is good, but we've been getting slagged off for a long time because there really hasn't been any competitive racing in the United States in the superbike class. So his opportunity to prove himself and prove that, you know, the United States can still put out good racers. Mm-hmm. I desperately want to see Haga do really well before he retires and the guy's not getting any younger. In fact, he set a record this at Phillip Island for having the most consecutive winning seasons in World Superbike. I think it was 10. And that's more than anybody. Wow.
What does that mean by winning seasons? He has never actually won a championship.
He's had wins in 10 consecutive seasons.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, that's true. We were talking about that last year, that his first full season was actually the closest he came to the only time he actually really led the championship.
But you know, he's kind of the Randy Mamola of World Superbike. He's got a lot of oh God, I'm in trouble for that. You're great, Randy.
You're not the first person who said that, actually. So
okay, And so those two off the top, I would like to see Biaggi. I'd like to see the Aprilias do well. I'd like to see either guy do well. I think Shinya's, you know, he's kind of just he's doing his donkey work right now. It'd be fun to see Biaggi do well. He's not my favorite rider, but I'm not the only person in that seat. I would like to see Courser. I want to see Chaus rip. You know, Courser's clearly a good rider. I want to see what Chaus can do with the BMW. Yet neither of them have been beating up the bodywork yet, and it's some really carbon fiber, and really nice carbon fiber. So we'll see how that works out.
I'm sure Zaus will take care of that.
I'm pretty sure he will. I was very impressed with some of the secondary teams. Haslam apparently with Stiggy is going to be coming with some new engine parts.
He's a very interesting guy. I see him doing very well this year.
I do too.
Like in a surprising way.
I wouldn't be surprised if I would expect to see him make the final Super Pole and qualify well. We can talk about Super Pole a little bit. Now that I understand a little bit better.
It's funky, but I like it.
It's funky and it's interesting, and I think once everybody gets their strategery brain wrapped around it and what they can do with the amount of qualifying tires that they have, I haven't quite confirmed that they only have two sets to deal with the three.
Yeah,
tires.
Which is why the first one is very tricky to choose.
It does have a tendency to, I think in the end, when people figure this out, to truly force the cream to the top. The guys that are going to be fast. I had a conversation with somebody else. It's like, and then this is a very philosophical question. Who do you want on the front row? Do you want the guy that can rip off one terrific lap, or do you want somebody that can consistently turn fast laps over an aggregate period of time?
Right. And the way they have it set up, one of those sessions, you're going to have to do it on a tire where
you're going to have to risk it.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's going to be a throw of the dice, because I think after a bit, you're going to see people settling into a similar strategy, and then you'll see the rebels.
Well, race, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're going to see somebody go, well, you know, there are going to be people that are going to be happy to get into the final one and have no qualifiers left.
Right.
I think that's what you're going to see happening. You're going to see people, you know, maybe one guy that.
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about the two front rows, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with those places.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting. I think it will make for some interesting gambles. I would like to see, well, first up, frankly, I'd like to see one live, and being here in the States, that'll be fun if we ever do.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with those people of you around the world that happened to see the Neil Hodgson's discussion with the AMA people over the non-live telecasted Super Bowl that they're running here in AMA now. He's like, you know, Super Bowl is a fantastic thing, and I think it works. But it's the most boring thing in the world if you watch it 2 weeks later when you already know what's happening, because it's just one guy going around and around. You can't look at the splits and know that it's even interesting. Thank you, Neil. Still my hero. It's the same thing. Not being able to see Super Bowl live, I don't really care about it later.
Yeah, exactly. I just look at this. But I did actually watch.
I've watched
just
it.
A couple of days ago. I did watch it because people were saying, you know, you should really check it out. It's very interesting, though.
It is. And and so, you know, that'll be great. And I think it will add an interesting thing to it. I think nobody had it figured out at PIN, I think, or Phillip Island. I think as the season goes on, it should make for some exciting stuff. So I think as long as the weather holds out, so those are kind of the guys. I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe Smertz do well again. He seemed to have a bit of a grip on it.
Locatelli. Not Locatelli. Lacone, Jesus Christ.
Lacone looked really good, and it's straight through qualifying and in the beginning of was race one, right? I think that'll be good. Looking forward to it. It should be a good weekend, and I think Qatar is an interesting circuit as long as you don't pan beyond the edges of the track.
and don't expect any up and down, except for bumps.
Oh, it actually has some elevation. It has camber changes that are so severe they almost look like elevation changes.
That's true.
Some of the photography from there, you'd think that there were small hills that they were traveling over. And then Supersport. I think Supersport's gonna be great all season.
I haven't even watched the Supersport races from the race from Phillip Island yet.
Ah, well, it should do before this weekend comes up. It was a great race. It was a lot of fun to watch. It was great last.
Well, I know the results because you talked about them with Eugene. Yeah. So.
Well, it was great last year, and I think it's carried great into this season. You've got a whole bunch of new people. It's nice to see the Brits, just this huge influx of Brits into both Superbike and Supersport. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like, it's not the greatest thing for BSB, although I think that will recover nicely. You've still got some good people over there, and those kind of holes are usually quickly filled in with talent.
I would say that there's never going to be a lack of good riders. I mean, it's just getting a team together. That's the tricky part.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's getting a team together to exploit, to have the funds to exploit that rider and develop them into something that will make, that will keep the series relevant and interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Super Sports could be a lot of fun to watch. I'm looking forward to watching these as soon as possible, and I am very happy to know that I will be able to watch both of these on Saturday on Speed TV, back to back. So my thanks to Speed for this, even if I can't watch all my other racing necessarily when I want to. So thank you, Speed. Those are on Saturday afternoon. Don't forget. This is a Saturday race.
That's right. Yep.
It is on in pretty much. Actually, I think Eurosport Span, I think they call it, is going to be tape delayed, but Eurosport 2 will have it live for most of you folks that listen to that, and then all over the world, there's a whole bunch of channels, and at rideon2.com, I'll be putting up pictures and running commentary from us and the rest of the folks. And then I should, if all goes well, be talking to Eugene on Sunday night, back at his home in Tunbridge, Ireland.
Sweet. He's going to be back already from Kentucky?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's a Saturday race. Jeez. And that trip is nowhere near as bad as his super long 21-hour one, right, or 25-hour one from Australia.
Yeah.
And cool. So... Yeah.
Excellent. It'll be good to check in with him, throughout the season. Just see how that all unfolds.
Yeah. And the more and more we talk, the more and more animated he gets. And
yeah.
Kind of shy as we started, but.
Yeah. He's definitely coming out of the show. That's great.
Just a quick mention. The rideon2.com tipping competition for MotoGP, and kind of wish it was World Superbike right now, but don't have that fully together. Going to try and have that all together for the upcoming season before the Jerez test, which is the end of this month. So if you haven't done it, please come and do it. Rideon2.com. That's RIDONTWO.com. And you can sign up. It's free. We don't spam. We've got no ads. It's really cool. And if you have done it, please come back and do it again.
Yeah. And try to beat me this year.
Yeah, whatever. All right. Thanks again.
All right. Ciao.
Yeah.
Okay, that's going to do it for the show. And thank you for listening and downloading the show. And we'll catch up with you next week. Bye.